Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth Perler with TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit. I'm really glad you're here, and I'm really glad to be here today with Jenna B. Hi, Jenna.
Wow.
I've known Jenna for a long time, and Jenna is very gifted at working with kids. She has a way of really unpacking complicated brains and figuring out what they need and connecting with them as human beings. And she's really good at a lot of different things. And I think that when she brings that to the table with working with kids, she's just gifted, I think, at being able to see strengths in people and make them shine. And today we're going to talk a lot about ACT, SAT, and college prep related stuff as it relates to executive function. So hi, Jenna.
Hello.
Tell us two or three things about you as far as your personal life outside of working with kids. What do we need to know about who Jenna is?
Yeah. So I have a lot of different projects going just about all the time. I have a lot of different interests. I am a yoga teacher. I am a sales manager. So those are more like the professional things, but also I have a lot of trouble doing professional things that I'm not interested in. So I consider most of my professional suits to be professional pursuits. I don't have any professional suits. professional pursuits to be personal interests as well. So I work at a tech startup and manage a sales team there. A part of the sales team, and I am a musician in my free time, a little less than I'd like to be. I teach yoga and host events that build community around Boulder and really anywhere. So I've done a lot of different things, and I have a way of kind of always being working, but depending on the time in my life and the projects that are going on, sometimes it feels like I'm never working either.
What about your professional background a little bit? How did you, or what have you done in terms of working with kids?
So I started working with kids when I was a kid, I guess. I grew up with younger sisters and a ton of younger cousins. And as far back as I can remember, I was directing plays and, just kind of coordinating the efforts of kids and in all forms. I was a camp counselor at theater camps and stuff like that. And then as I went to college, I did some tutoring in an inner city after school program, and things got to be like a little more formal. And that's really when I first started dabbling in SAT, ACT stuff. I had performed pretty well on the tests myself, but also I felt a real big shift. And so without going on to too far of a tangent, but I think this will be relevant. I always did well in school and had a pretty good understanding of like how things work together. But I was really struck by the systemic nature of the SAT and the ACT. I took the SAT in one of the last years before they got rid of analogies and did that kind of whole reworking that they did a number of years ago. If you don't know about that history of it, like, don't worry, it's not super important, but it was even more systematized then. And there was such a strategy to kind of decode it and break it down that I just felt that huge shift in my mind. And I was like, how do people take this test if they haven't had that conversation and taken the, 8-week, $7 million prep course or whatever it was at the time? I just remember it being about as long and as expensive as like driver's ed, which was another thing I was doing around the time. And it was a huge like piece of my life. And so I started teaching kids or working with kids on SAT, ACT stuff when I was in college. So pretty recently after that experience for me, I was working was volunteering in a program called Let's Get Ready, which was focused on less privileged populations and supporting them with just some of the basic tools of how to approach a standardized test that maybe no one in their life had ever taken before.
Yeah, there's a huge cultural bias in the test that people don't talk about very often. But when you come from a family who's able to afford SAT and ACT test prep, and you're evaluating everybody's SAT and SAT scores, and you're evaluating those kids with kids who have never seen the test or haven't had the opportunity for the same test prep and stuff, it's not a level playing field. So
totally. Yeah. And I just remember being really present to that before I really came to understand in any larger sense the privilege that I came into in this world and in this life. I was incredibly fortunate to have a really supportive family. And my parents, I was also the oldest, and I was identified for better or for worse as like very smart when I was really young, which is great. And like, thanks to all the people who helped me have that opinion of myself. And I think as I've gotten older, I've just learned how powerful it has been for me to have had that opinion of myself from like age four. Mm-hmm. There's like a famous story in my family where I like introduced myself to one of my grandparents' friends or something. And they were like, "Oh, Jenna, nice to meet you." And I was like, "I'm very smart."
Yeah.
You know, so I was a precocious little kid.
Yeah.
And so I feel fortunate that that was my default setting. And
right.
I think I've acquired a little more humility as I've gotten older, but also, just identifying that way. And so I think for so many kids, regardless of their privilege, regardless of how wonderful and nice and smart their parents were or whatever, I don't mean to like blame parents for kids not having that identity by any means, but I think there are a lot of different voices and a lot of different contexts, and whatever message lands with your kid, they're likely to carry it with them for a while.
Yep. There's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy and a lot of influence that culture and society and family and people around us influence our own mindset and perception of ourselves. And you and I and all the adults watching spend years or decades sort of unraveling that and coming to ask the question as an adult, what is my truth? What does Seth think about Seth? What does Jenna think about Jenna? What does Jenna think about every, you know, and getting sort of, we have to sort of undo some of the training or, I don't know the word to use, but the ideas that we grew up with and really figure out what's our truth with all this stuff.
Yeah.
And to have that influence as a kid to be like, oh yeah, you to get the messages, you're smart, you're awesome, blah, blah, blah. Not all kids that have that. And especially people watching this, we have a lot of parents of 2E kids, and we have parents in the summit of a lot of kids who have not been told that, particularly through a system that values certain things and not other things. And these kids may be brilliant in certain areas, but it may not be measured or noticed.
And so I think I saw that as a kid who was both like high achieving, but also really empathetic. I think I saw it in my peers that I was like, Joey is really smart, but you know, Mrs. whatever her name is, isn't listening to him. And I think I saw that like, she wasn't doing that on purpose either, but I could see these disconnects and like, well, but he, you know, when he plays with blocks, it's different than when Susie does or whatever. And I think I started to see those things in my own peers when I was younger. And so it made me start to ask myself, you know, I never felt quite comfortable in my advanced classes and stuff. I think socially I felt less comfortable there. So I don't know. It caused me to start looking. I never identified as a part of any one group in school through my whole upbringing. And I think that's part of what led me to wear so many hats as an adult, but also to continue to see different things in different people at different times throughout my life. And I think that anyway, to go back to the string of my professional background, sorry, I'm a little nonlinear. I started working with kids when I was in college in a more formal setting. And then I also, just to get really meta with it, I oversaw student volunteers who were also teaching kids. So I started to learn about pedagogy, not in an academic way. I don't have any degrees in teaching, but I have taught in a lot of different contexts, and I have supported teachers in a lot of different ways. And then when I graduated from college, I became a yoga teacher, and have continued to do that, supporting yoga teachers and yoga students. And
then you've done some pretty advanced SAT and ACT training. You don't have to name the companies, but you've done some pretty deep trainings.
At different points, I've considered joining in with some of the bigger name test prep organizations, who are great, to be honest. Like, they do a good job and they have it down to a science. And for the right kind of kid, those programs are awesome. They're expensive. And also they're group oriented. So a lot of the individual work that I've done in more recent years with kids has been one-on-one, because families are finding me when they know that their kid is not going to do well with either the schedule or the format or the just sheer magnitude of other students in those bigger classes.
Yeah. So one of the things I like about Jenna is she wasn't a teacher, doesn't have like a teaching degree or anything, but she is amazing at what she does because I've seen her work with so many different types of kids and she really understands different brains. And if you're watching this and you're from a different country where you don't have the SAT or ACT, I want to encourage you to watch. There are thousands of parents on this summit. Mm-hmm. And we have people from other countries that don't have the same testing. We're going to try to make this as relevant to you as possible. And then we also have families on here who think testing is a bunch of BS. We don't even like it, but our kid has to do it. It's a necessary evil, or maybe we'll do it, maybe we won't, all the way to the other end of the spectrum where parents are like, oh yeah, this is the most important thing in the world. We want every single detail we can. Yeah. And Jenna, as we know that we have sort of this wide variety of people, I think that mindset is something that's so important. I'm going to ask you about executive function in a moment, but just to start this talk off so that parents can really hear, you know, do I want to get more out of what Jenna is going to teach us? When we have parents from all these different mindsets, what are the key things they should keep take into consideration when thinking about these high stakes tests?
I think that these high stake tests are, I mean, thankfully, I think the idea that they're not quite as high stakes is becoming more mainstream, which is great. And I think it's important to recognize them as a piece of the puzzle. And that's all they are. And for a lot of kids who struggle with other things, it's a powerful opportunity to like tackle this particular piece of the puzzle. Because actually, I think a lot of kids who struggle in school stand to do really well on these tests if they're relating to them properly. I think if you know that your kid struggles with testing, then it's important to set realistic expectations and to trust the rest of their application, but really the rest of their person to carry their application. And to me, the goal of any application process, whether it be a job or a college or a high school or anything, is that you end up in the right place. And so I really strive to help families put together a college application that represents who the student is. And that can sound a little like airy fairy maybe and woo-woo and maybe overly affirming or something, but I think the best way for someone, a candidate of any kind, to end up in the right place is to represent truly who they are and have somebody be looking at that on the other side. So the more dimensions you can provide to your application, great. But then also the application is just a snippet and just like a slice of the high school experience, or again, the career experience, whatever the application may be. And so I think it really goes back to like supporting our kids and living lives that they want to be living. And if a kid is living the life they want to be living, like the actors are going to act and the soccer players are going to play soccer and the mathematicians are going to do math. And if we let our students connect, and obviously they need our guidance and they need some discipline and they need help. I'm not saying like just let everybody guide everything completely for themselves, because obviously as teenagers, a lot of times we're not the most resourced to be making those decisions, but within reason to really be looking for the strengths in our students and leaning into those. And if sitting and taking a test for 4 hours is really going to ruin a kid's life, I am not an advocate for doing it, but I also think that with the right conversation around it and the right framing, a 4-hour test is not going to ruin a kid's life. So depending on how much time I have with a family or a student, I'm talking about these much bigger picture issues of supporting a confident kid, because a confident kid is going to be like, okay, 4 hours, I'm going to sit down and fill in some circles. And to be honest, that's how I think about these tests, is like, let's sit down and fill in some circles and see if it helps. And if it doesn't, then the rest of the application is going to be fine. But I think that for a lot of kids, we can turn these tests into an asset, into an opportunity to put a number on something, because so much of the application process is subjective, as it should be. But we can throw a number on something, and it just helps to give a context in terms of comparing, performance across the board. And I really do think a lot of admissions departments are getting better at looking at these tests in context. And I also think that there's value to supporting a kid and being able to do something they don't want to do for 4 hours.
And being able to focus.
Yeah, totally. Or being okay with the fact that they can't focus. You know, right. In meditation, we talk about the wandering mind, and it's, you sit down and the wandering of your mind is not a maybe, it is a given. It is, your mind will wander if you're a human being, unless, you're having an experience that I know nothing about.
So that brings us right into executive function. Can you give us a quick definition of executive function?
Totally. I think of executive function like our operating system. And so if I have all these different programs or apps or something that I can run, like Jenna the singer, Jenna the writer, Jenna the manager, if I don't have the right operating system to access those, then nobody knows. I don't even know sometimes that I have these skills. And so to me, executive function is our ability to access our innate and acquired skills effectively.
Awesome. I like that. It reminds me of the little conversation we were having about wearing different hats earlier. It's almost like knowing which hat to wear when.
Yeah, exactly. It's like an index.
So then that leads beautifully into ACT. So we'll talk about college stuff later, but let's talk about ACT and SAT specifically now. So that leads beautifully into that. If a kid doesn't perceive that they're wearing an SAT, ACT hat, how do you help the student? So how can a parent who's watching right now help their student who's like, no, I'm going to do bad. I don't want to do that. I resist that. How do we help them change the mindset, what you just said before, and give a good frame to it? How does the parent come at it not with anxiety and I need to convince you, but how do they come at it in sort of a cool way that will connect and land? And then I'm going to ask you about the opposite too, because not all kids are resistant to it. So I'll ask about that in a moment, because I think that's important.
Great question. I mean, I think the best way to frame it, and this definitely came out of some of my training with some of the bigger test prep companies, is that your SAT score is really great at indicating how good you are at taking the SAT. That's it. It doesn't indicate how good you're going to be at a job. It doesn't indicate what you're going to succeed in college. It doesn't indicate how smart you are, how good of a person you are, or anything. Just like, to make a yoga comparison for anybody who practices yoga, which if you don't, that's okay. Don't let this turn you off. But like crow pose or any kind of hard yoga pose is really great at indicating how good you are at doing that pose. It doesn't mean it can't be useful to teach us how to do other things. It can teach us about discipline. It can teach us about putting time in to develop a skill. It can teach us about attachment and aversion. I think the SAT can do the same things. As long as we remember that our SAT score does not represent anything about us except for how good we are at taking the SAT.
So then we get that other kid who's like, whatever, I don't really care. And then we get the other side where you have a kid who struggles with executive function, but they also have test anxiety. They put a lot of weight on it. They're saying things like, well, if I don't have all these things, if I don't do this after school activity and put that on my application, I'm not going to get into the college I want. If I get too low of a score, I'm not going to get into this college. And there's all this pressure around them.
And that's where I go back to the, like, live your life. You don't want to get into a school by portraying this person that you aren't. Otherwise you're going to have to be that person when you get there.
How do you sift through that, in that the pressure often comes from parents or culture or society or school or the school culture that they happen to be in? If they're in a culture that really puts heavy emphasis, how do you tell a student or even a parent who's watching, look, your kid's going to be okay, I promise you. They may not get the score you think they should. That's a conversation that's come up in many of the people on the summit, in terms of really accepting your kid for where they're at and changing your expectations and looking at the human being that's right there and being really okay with whoever they are.
Yeah, to me, I think it's about zooming out and just, again, the test score is a very minuscule part about you. It doesn't say anything about the relationships you have in your life or or the job you can have. I mean, so many of the most successful people, and I mean that not just financially, but like the happiest, most satisfied people who are having the biggest impact in our world don't have college degrees, never mind got a good SAT score. I got a great SAT score, and I really struggled in my 20s to figure out my professional identity and how I wanted to be having an effect in the world. So there's not this universal correlation. It's not like put all your effort into getting an SAT score because then everything else is going to be figured out. So you really, I'm a big advocate for spreading your effort out, spreading it out to, you know, figuring out how to have a relationship with your body, whether that means being an athlete or developing, you know, the things that feel good for you, hiking or movement or meditation or anything like that in terms of like health and wellness. That's a big thing that I think we have the opportunity to learn as young adults. Figuring out how to communicate with people. Like all these things are as important, if not more important than an SAT score. And if you're building those skills as a young adult, I think no matter where you end up at school, whether it's, you know, community college or Ivy League or a coding boot camp, those skills are going to be what helps you get the most out of any of those situations. And so putting all your effort into performing, if you don't have the like personal skills and confidence to show up wherever you end up, then it really doesn't matter. And you just kind of wasted your time.
So are there any, when you're working with a kid that doesn't fit in the box, are there any big myths or misunderstandings that you've heard parents say so many times when they first started with you that are notable to share?
That's a good question too. I mean, without wanting to be a broken record, I think just like that the test means everything.
Got it.
Yeah, cool. Or that you have to take it, or that you definitely shouldn't take it. I guess that's one thing I wanted to say too. I've worked with a lot of families in Boulder, Colorado, and there are a lot of, which is great, there are a lot of alternative educational approaches happening in Boulder. And I think that's awesome. And as a result, a lot of students have never taken a standardized test before they take the SAT or the ACT. I won't get into whether I recommend opting out or opting in to state testing or any of that kind of thing. I will say that, you know, when I was in middle school and high school, I took extra standardized tests. Whether that was the best use of my time, I don't know, but it did help me to be more desensitized when I sat down to take the SAT. So again, I just wasn't freaked out. I had that executive function present. And what I think happens to so many kids is they sit down, they look at the thing, they're like, "Wah!" And then their operating system totally shuts down. They can't access math. They can't access writing. They can't access language or vocabulary or anything like that. And so I really do think it's different for every kid, but the common denominator is self-acceptance and confidence.
So that moves us into a great place right now, something very practical for parents. So you have these parents watching, and what happens to a lot of kids who struggle with executive function and a lot of kids who don't struggle with executive function is they sit down and they go, and you said they can't access things in their brain. So when they can't access those parts of their brain, it's because they're stressed. So their body is putting a lot of its resources towards stress, and we want kids walking into the test that they're taking, feeling confident and calm. Everybody's going to feel probably some sense of nervousness, which is normal. But how does a parent who's watching, or what methods do you use, and how can parents adapt those? You know, if they're working with their kid for a month or 8 weeks to prep for the test, parents, as you're watching this, please do not think that I don't even believe in tests. I have very strong opinions about them, but. They are a necessary evil, and they exist. And if you're taking it, and we are prepping, and I do prep kids for tests, but I put it in perspective. But if you have a month or two, which generally is how long the courses are, or how long you work with kids to prep, this is a long question, but I want to set it up. How do you help the kids go in there as calm as possible, having resources, and what can you tell parents that they might be able to do in their process?
I think one of the most tangible things to do is to go into the body somehow. So I start with having kids put their feet flat on the floor.
for someone who's never heard that phrase before and is not from Boulder, because we have,
I'm like checking.
What does it mean? Go into your body.
Right. I think, so the physical body is an access point that is tangible. And so if I say calm down, that doesn't really mean anything to people sometimes. So if I'm like coming with this energy, and I'll try to demonstrate it via video, if I'm coming with this energy and you say calm down, I might not have any idea what the access point to calm down is. But to break that down, I can like take my left foot and put it on the floor. Take my right foot, put it on the floor. Let my hands rest in my lap, maybe close my eyes to minimize kind of visual stimulation, and then take a deep breath. And I don't know if you can see over video, but that changes my whole demeanor.
Not only does it change your demeanor, it made me take a breath. And for parents that are watching their mirror neurons, I bet almost everybody watching probably took a deep breath as well. So we can model anxiety as an adult in our kids' life, and they feel that, but we can also model that groundedness, as you just probably experienced with Jenna B, in terms of when we do that. So I just wanted to point that out for everybody watching, that one of the things that we can do is help them access their body through communication, like put your foot on the ground, whatever. We can also do it by modeling or mirroring it to them ourselves. And I often do this in my practice. I just go, so if I see a kid who's dysregulated and we're starting to talk and I can tell something's up with them, I might do that. I'm not saying to them, take a deep breath, relax, but I am modeling for them, hey, I'm stable for you, I'm here. And it often takes them down a notch in their anxiety.
I mean, and I'll just take this opportunity then to plug like self-care for parents. I don't have kids of my own yet, but I know from working with other people's and with other adults that if I'm not taking care of myself, there is no way I can model that energy for kids.
You can't fake it.
Yeah. And then we take on, and then the whole thing just climbs. And I know that we're all juggling so many things in our lives, but to model taking care of yourself, whether just the process or the result, like the importance of you getting real with your own stuff. And so, you know, whether that means therapy or yoga practice or meditation or your own exercise and wellness regime or what you're eating, you know, all of those things can really affect the way that a kid shows up in the world. And if you're having trouble having your kid adopt some of those things, I just would always encourage, you know, looking at your adoption of those things and really trying to figure out, again, not to like have any shame or like perfection image about it, but to see what small chunks you can bite off to just like move in a more balanced and grounded and self-loving direction. Mm-hmm.
So when you have a real live person coming to you for 6 or 8 weeks or whatever, a kid, and you're going to teach them to get in their body, and it's like the first time you're bringing this up. And I ask you this because the parent that's watching, maybe they can model some of what you would do in a real practical way. Would you set them up with a little conversation about it first, or do you go straight into an exercise?
I know this isn't a super helpful answer, but I really think it depends on the kid, I'll just say. I think the biggest thing that we can do as teachers, parents, friends, students is to listen and to notice and trust ourselves a little bit. I mean, and it takes a little bit to be able to trust yourself to know what someone else might need. But you've probably been trying to figure out how to do that as a parent since your kid was born. So trusting yourself to the same way you looked at them and said, do they need a diaper change, or are they hungry, or are they cold, or whatever, before your kids were verbal. I mean, I would just apply some of that wisdom of, does it seem like they need to run around? Are they dehydrated? Have they been getting enough sleep? And so I always start there. But then in terms of like sitting down to actually start working.
So let me interrupt you. So that's called attunement or tuning. And many of the speakers have spoken about attuning. It's almost easier when you have a baby because we're so attuned to them. But by the time our kid's 14 years old and we've had all these homework battles and all these things, you know, we're not always in the moment to attune. But what Jenna's saying is to pause, look at what's going on with their body language, notice what they need, maybe even reflect it back to them. I'll do that a lot. I'll say, I know she looked a little stressed about this. And then what Jenna said is listen. So I'm not saying, I just stop there. I notice you look stressed about this or whatever and see what happens. Go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that noticing can often provide the space because depending on the personality of your kid and your, you know, other elements of your relationship with your kid, or certainly if they're not your own kid, to say, you know, you seem stressed might give them the space to be like, wow, I am. Or like, no, I'm not stressed. I'm hungry. Or like, no, I'm stressed. I'm not stressed. I have to go to the bathroom or whatever. These things that they're, it might not always
they have to even ask the question to themselves that they might not even have noticed.
Yeah.
Which is mindfulness.
Totally. Exactly. And really, I mean, I have this conversation about yoga and meditation and mindfulness all the time. It's like, that's all mindfulness is, giving yourself the space to notice what is actually happening. And then to decide what you want to do with what's actually happening. And so I think that that's a great place to start this test prep from. And so in terms of practical tools, it really depends on what a student's experience is with or without any of those, I call them practices, but like the practice of just noticing, right, the practice of breathing. So I think that the practical form of a session with every kid is really, really different. Somebody might want to walk and have a conversation with some people. For most of 6 to 8 weeks, we're having conversations like this about what does and doesn't matter and just trying to help them be more comfortable with where they are in their life. One of the things I was thinking of before, I forget what the question was that you were asking me, but one of the things that I think can be really helpful to kids is connecting with people who are not at the same place in life that they are. Maybe someone like between their age and their parents' age, or several people in that spectrum, or younger kids. You know, being able to teach some of the things that they know is a great way to build confidence, especially if kids maybe don't have younger siblings or other kids around where they get to practice being better at things than other people. And I don't mean that to be identifying that other people are worse, but to recognize that they have something to offer in a situation, to being able to be of service is just such a great way to build confidence, I think, in kids of any age. And then connecting with mentors, which is kind of a fancy buzzword, but young adults, people who are in their careers, people who are going out and trying to figure out what this stuff means when the rubber meets the road, understanding that there is life after college. There's certainly life after college applications. There's college after college applications. I think some kids have their heads down in their college admissions process so much that they forget they're going to go to college at the end of it. Mm-hmm. That can result in a lot of overwhelm when you finally land on campus and then have to figure out how to have executive function. And as you know, and as I'm sure you're addressing with a lot of your other presenters in this summit, I mean, that's a whole other situation. And so to really reserve some resources, that sounds like there's a limited amount of resources, but to acknowledge that the journey will continue after this process, again, no matter what. And if we're building holistic skills to support a whole person in this process, then wherever they land, they are going to be more equipped to make the most of it.
Right. Very well said. Very well said. So you're working with somebody who does struggle with executive function, attention, concentration, focus, organization, time management, knowing what time it is during the test, keeping an eye on the clock, having a realistic perception of time. Well, let's talk specifically about a couple of key strategies that you find yourself saying over and over and over.
The deep breath strategy is a great one.
No, I'm sorry. I meant specifically the test taking.
The test taking part.
When you're prepping someone for the SAT or ACT, do you teach them test taking strategies like elimination?
Oh yeah, totally. Just to keep going is one of the big overarching themes. Is if you're tripped up by a question, you can skip it, and to read the whole question. So I guess more mechanically, those are the strategies we're getting into.
Let's get into that a little bit for a few.
Yeah, sure. I mean, just how to read. I mean, it's hard to say because it's really different for SAT and ACT. It's really different from math to verbal to science to vocab. Mm. I guess one universal test-taking thing I would say is vocabulary. Students who read anything have a much easier time with reading comprehension and with having a vocabulary that matches up with the test. And that's one of the easiest skills to be just building from the minute you start thinking about this stuff or even before, to just be, I encourage every family who has a student prepping for these tests to buy flashcards. I mean, you could make them if you don't want to buy them, but they're not that expensive, and to just get small pieces of paper with words people don't know and definitions on the back and do anything with them, whether it's fun for you to have them at the dinner table and pull out five of them after everybody finishes eating, and to just kind of work them into conversation, tell funny stories, sing songs, think of what they rhyme with, come up with weird mnemonics, cartoon characters that words remind you of, or whatever, just to help students start to develop a relationship with these vocabulary words. Because again, when a kid's taking a test and they all of a sudden encounter a word that they don't use, that they don't know, it can, if they're not well prepared, trigger like a fight or flight response where they're like, oh, I don't know that word, I'm the worst. And then it just like goes on this whole thing, and then they're done. And so more than test prep strategies, I am going back to these ways of trying not to get derailed, not shutting down the operating system. And when we get past all that and the kid's like, okay, I'm ready to learn how to do a multiple choice reading test, the relationship with the questions is really important. So whether it's a content question or a theme question or a vocabulary question, looking at what is the actual question? What is it asking? Not worried about sometimes the four sentences that might be before it, but if it's like, what is the author saying? Or what happened to make the character nervous? Or the metaphor involving the oak tree is best described as trying to represent multiple choice, you know? Being able to pull apart the actual question is a great one skill that every kid can learn, because the thing that all of those sections of all of the tests have in common is that they are all on paper or a computer. They are all text that you have to read. So even the math test is hard if you can't read.
I think that's a really great point. And I think that I could really see like using practice tests in such a way, like I don't teach conventionally, but I could see that just inspires me to, if I'm doing this year with anybody, like even look at the practice tests and I don't even care what the answer is, but ask them to read it and tell me what the question is, yeah, and see, I mean, if they do that, and then not even worry about answering it, but going on to other ones and saying, what's this question asking me? Because that is a great, and it doesn't necessarily seem like you're teaching the right thing, but you're teaching them how to think.
And I mean, so when we're talking about life beyond the SAT, life beyond college, life beyond, like, this is only a piece of it, but that's a skill that helps any of us, right? I mean, how many of us adults are in conversations, personal and professional, and we're like, I'm sorry, what did you just ask me? What was the question? What are you saying? That comprehension is not just a standardized test skill.
And the tests seem to be masters that sort of implying that they're going in one direction, but you have to really see what direction they're actually going in.
Yeah, they're definitely written to trick you. I think that the test makers have come under a lot of scrutiny for that lately. And so I honestly think it's getting a little bit better. There have been changes to these tests. And so I won't say that that's not happening still. I think more often what trips people up, what tricks people, is their relationship to the test, more so than the way that it's written. So yeah, for whatever that's worth. I just think being able to break it into bite-sized pieces and not freaking out by things that are unfamiliar. And again, if that's not a life skill, I don't know what is.
And then what about the night before the test and the morning of a test?
Yeah, definitely just plenty of sleep, but also whatever you're accustomed to. So I guess, I mean, to use an extreme example that I hope isn't true for anyone, if your kid doesn't sleep ever at night or whatever, then I guess they shouldn't sleep the night before the test. Like the moral of the story is there's no formula for everyone. Familiarity is good. That said, your kid might not usually wake up at whatever time they're going to wake up on test day. And so that's something to recognize. So I think you don't want to shock the system being your student's system in general. So consistency is good. So if someone does have terrible sleep or eating habits or whatever, I guess I would just say the night before the test is not the time to eat something new, sleep in a different way. You know, it's not the time to correct all of the mistakes of the rest of their life just the night before the test. If you know a few months before the test that sleep hygiene is a problem, that diet is a problem, or anything else like that you have control over, start incrementally course correcting way before. So really think about, instead of the night before the test, the week before the test. And I know that's hard. It's high school. You know, there's games and there's dance. And
do you recommend doing a practice test the night before?
Absolutely not.
Me neither.
No way. Probably not even the week before, to be honest. I mean, the bottom line with all this test prep stuff, you're not really going to learn new material during this test prep portion. With a few exceptions, maybe you'll learn a couple of rules to memorize special relationships of triangles, and maybe you'll learn new words. Other than that, you're not trying to learn new material to show on this test. And honestly, the material on these tests are pretty basic for most students in terms of the actual content. And the challenge is that operating system, that executive function, that accessing the tools that I have. So if a kid doesn't have all the tools they need, the test prep situation is not the time they're going to acquire them. So what we're trying to do is just get the student, or support the student, in accessing the information that they already have in this strange environment. There was somewhere else I was going there. So just developing those healthy habits is creating more likelihood that they're going to be able to access what they already know. And so cramming for it in any way is just totally unproductive. It's just going to increase anxiety, exhaustion. So any effort you would want to put into test prep the week before the test, I would put into meal prep and sleep and other kind of wellness things, just to help somebody show up at their best.
And for a family who either can't afford one of the programs that are available, or who doesn't want their kid to go to one of the programs because they're just like, my kid, or their kid, just, they know that sitting in that seat in that context just isn't right for their kid's brain and stuff like that, can they just buy one of the books and use that creatively? How many practice tests should they take in 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 8 weeks, or what? And I know that you said each kid's different, but just a general, for a kid who struggles with this stuff, what are some guidelines like can they watch some great videos online that help? I mean, where do they go if they're like, look, let's figure out a simple way where we can keep our sanity, but still do a little bit to prep?
Yeah. Again, I think that vocab and flashcards, there are tons of free and low cost.
What do you look up on online to buy SAT prep test flashcards? Okay.
SAT or ACT. And honestly, the vocab for most of them is pretty similar. And as the tests have evolved over the years, they've actually gotten more and more similar, the SAT and the ACT. When I was in high school, they were really different in their format. They're getting more and more similar.
So get the flashcards for vocab.
Flashcards for vocab. Books with practice tests are great. Now, again, like I said, getting accustomed to sitting there and looking at a sheet with a bunch of circles on it, especially if a kid's never taken standardized tests before, is going to just really help. But you're not going to want to just say, okay, let's do a 4-hour practice test, kitchen table, go. I'm setting a timer. So I really think breaking them into bite-sized pieces.
Great.
The books are really great. I really like the Princeton Reviews resources, and honestly usually use them with students when I'm working with them one-on-one. Left to their own devices. Again, most of the students that we're talking about, most of the students that are inspiring you to be here listening, you're probably not going to want to just say, here's the book, good luck. That's probably going to be pretty daunting and pretty discouraging. So anything you can do to either yourself, or if you don't want to be the person having this relationship with your student, I mean, find anybody who's willing to listen to them. And you know, when I'm pushed to,
that's a really good point. You can actually hire a college kid to go through the book with them. Someone who's cool and fun and weird and who likes your kid and your kid likes them. And
exactly.
Like, and it's not really that complicated.
That person might even have some resistance and be like, what do you mean? I can't tutor your kid. And you could then help them know. I mean, when I'm pushed out of my comfort zone to tutor in, you know, calculus or something that I'm not, I don't use calculus day to day, and I did not get an advanced math degree or anything like that. I took calculus, but it's been a minute. What I need to do to support someone in calculus usually has very little to do with calculus. It's helping them access what they learned or didn't learn in class. All I need to be able to do is be able to read the materials that they're getting from their teacher, read the textbook, sometimes be in contact with the teacher, but it's more of a translation game than actually saying like, well, I know calculus like the back of my hand. And I think that's why sometimes teachers who are really good at calculus are not great at teaching calculus, because they know it so well. So actually, if someone's struggling a little to wrap their head around something, it's going to model for a student how to manage that struggle. Mm-hmm. So what you want to find in a tutor or a coach of any kind is someone who can help your student access their executive function, help them be comfortable, help them feel safe. I mean, I think that's why you're so successful with your students, Seth. I mean, I'm sure all of you guys have noticed that Seth's always got fun stuff going on, guitars in the background and music posters and all these things. And what that does is it sets a student at ease. And so if you and your student have a tense relationship already, you might not be the person to help them with their test prep. And that doesn't mean you're a bad parent.
No, actually, that's very, very, very normal too. Right. I hear parents all the time saying, my kid won't listen to me. I tell them the exact same thing, but they won't take it from me.
Yeah, totally.
So I hear that all the time from parents. So we have 10 minutes. I know you have to go soon. So can you tell us, so I'm going to wrap up with two questions that'll take about 2 minutes each. Mm-hmm. So in about 5 minutes, can you tell us about the college application process with a kid who is not responsible, who's forgetful, who doesn't feel like doing it, who's resistant to the details, who but wants to go to college and they want to do the application process? What do we need to know?
I would get them involved in the story and have as much conversation as possible of why do they want to go to college? What is college going to be like? Have them talk to people who have gone or are going to college. Again, maybe like if you went to college 30 years ago, maybe you don't count.
You said that earlier. You said someone between where you're at. And I think parents, there are so many people in your life, like use people that are in your circles that are a great influence on your kid. Pay for them to go to dinner and say, will you talk to my kid all about the college process or whatever? Like, use these great people in your life.
I think that's such a great lesson for kids to learn too young, is how to have these mentor type relationships. I mean, whether it's a startup meetup or a college question and answer or whatever, I feel like there are so many people who are like, how do I get a mentor? That's like this question. And it's like, you just ask them. A mentor is just a person who you ask a question to and they tell you, and you know, and you develop a relationship. There's no like mentor place,
mentor school or certification. Yeah.
And anyone can be a mentor. And I think, again, if we're talking about young people becoming mentors for younger people or peers, I think sometimes as adults or as teachers, parents, leaders, we can empower the mentor, which is incredibly valuable for the mentor. And, you know, so many, it's a little cliche, I think now, but so many mentors say that their experience as a mentor is even more valuable probably than the experience that the student is
having. The mentee.
Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to ask for that from people. And you, who knows, by asking the kid down the street to take your kid out to dinner, you might help that kid down the street see themselves in a totally different way, which is incredibly powerful. And so by teaching, and even if you're boosting that along, and even if your kid's like, what the heck, why do you want me to go to dinner with Susie? Supporting them through that awkwardness, because probably both of them are going to feel a little weird if nobody's ever had a thing like that before. But supporting them through that and trying to make it as easy and comfortable for them as possible is going to just really serve them well once when they're a young professional and when they're in college and things like that, to be able to ask for help.
So what's another, one more thing with the college application process that is notable?
That is notable.
I mean, that kids, you know, who, I guess there's a lot of details in the college, like this is a big executive function thing. Okay, I want to go to college. Great. Fill out an application. No, this is a lot of tiny details that must be managed. So in terms of helping, you know, parents help a kid who struggles with details and processes like this, what do we need to know?
How to ask for help. Show them how to ask for help by asking for help yourself. I hope all of you parents who are a part of this summit, I hope your kids know that you're a part of this summit. I think when parents let their kids know that they don't know how to be parents, that is really powerful. I know for a lot of young adults, you know, getting into college and the years beyond is part, a big part of that process is understanding your parents aren't perfect. And if you're trying to be a perfect parent to your kid, I would argue that you're maybe doing them a disservice and helping them see that you're not perfect. You're going to help them be okay with their own imperfections as a kid, as a student, as a friend, as a professional, and ultimately maybe as a parent again themselves.
Yeah. Vulnerability.
Totally.
I do that a lot with my students and on my vlog. For any of you who follow my vlog, I'm very open about being human and being imperfect.
And so
in fact, right before this call, when I spoke to Jenna, I was not in a good mindset. And I was like, I need to take a walk and reset and self-care.
And so knowing your tools and you doing that and asking me for that, I think was really important. But then also, I just think asking for help, again, cannot be encouraged enough. I think that so much of the mental health crisis that we see right now is people not knowing when and how and who to ask for help. So whether that's you or someone else, to just real, and whether it's with, you know, accountability and scheduling or with math homework.
Yeah.
Just knowing that it's okay and important to ask for help. And I know enough about your, you know, life structure and your business model, Seth. I know this has been a huge part of what you've learned as a professional, even after your education as an educator and all these other things. It's like, well, what kind of assistance do I need? What kind of, is it a virtual assistant? Is it a full-time assistant? Yeah. Is it a project-based thing or whatever? And as a business person, that's a big part.
I am successful in very, very large part because I know how to ask for help. And I tell my students that strong people ask for help. Successful people ask for help. It is so important. I say that in all my courses to kids. Like, it is one of the most important things I think we can give kids is to empower them to not have shame around it and learn to advocate and say, I care about me enough to ask for help. We got to wrap up. So remember that, our time.
Then they learn how to get help without having someone do things for them too. Because asking someone for help is different than saying like, Mom, do my math homework for me. It's saying, what is this Y equals MX plus B? Can you explain it to me in a different way? So figuring out how to ask for help or how to understand where the disconnect is. And again, it's all just practice. There's a million philosophies. There are a ton of strategies. There are a ton of formulas, and none of them is going to work perfectly for everybody. So really just practicing having these conversations, even when they're uncomfortable, especially when they're uncomfortable, and then maybe asking why they're uncomfortable and digging into all that stuff. I think that there's no conversation with your kid as a teenager, that is a waste of time. You're learning something, they're learning something all the time.
All right, my last two questions. Number one is, what is one action parents can take this week to implement some of what you teach?
Buy vocabulary flashcards.
Awesome. Last question. From your heart to the heart of the parent who's watching, who's like, I'm concerned about my kid, I'm here because I want to learn as much as I can, what is the most important takeaway you hope parents walk away with from your heart to theirs right now?
That the fact that you are here means you are doing a great job.
You kept those really simple and beautiful. Awesome. Thank you so much, Genevieve, for sharing your time, your heart, your effort, and your expertise with us.
Thank you so much. And I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody has too. So feel free to use the links in all of the, everything to reach out. Happy to have casual conversation or help any way that I can.
All right. Thank you, Jenna. All right, parents, go take action. We'll see you in the next.